From Mississippi to New Mexico, Texas to North Dakota, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, unhappy with the current constitutionalist tilt of the U.S. Supreme Court, the left is pushing a plan to expand and pack the bench with activist judges. Tom Gipping of the Heritage Foundation is here to explain why that would destroy the integrity of the court. Congress has not given up on the possibility of passing yet another COVID-19 relief package before the end of the year. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. The Biden administration will make climate change a top priority. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Josiah Neely from the R Street Institute about why Congress must be involved in policy decisions. And Joe Biden is poised to return America to the Obama years. On this week's American Radio Journal commentary, Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, says that is destructive to the ideals of liberty and opportunity. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Expanding the number of justices on the U.S. Supreme Court and packing the bench with activist jurists is on the left's to-do list. Thomas Gipping is Senior Legal Fellow and Deputy Director of the Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation. He is here to talk about the impact of such a move. Tom, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Tom, among the fundamental changes that have been discussed by the American left and which could potentially come to fruition should Democrats have control of the House, Senate, and the presidency is a packing of the U.S. Supreme Court. What do we mean by the term packing the court?
Well, that phrase actually has been around since the 1930s. It basically refers to increasing the number of positions on the Supreme Court so that those positions can be filled by judges of a certain persuasion. Franklin Roosevelt actually tried this in 1937. He was dissatisfied with the way the Supreme Court was ruling on his New Deal legislation, so he wanted to increase the size of the court, fill those positions with favorable justices so he could get his way. That plan was defeated by his own party. Democrats in Congress said that that was a very dangerous step that would undermine the independence of the judiciary, and the same is true today. So that the idea of packing the court has been around for a very long time.
In terms of the size of the Supreme Court, that's not set by the U.S. Constitution. It's something that Congress has the opportunity to do?
That's right. The Constitution created the Supreme Court, but it leaves to Congress to determine the number of positions on the Supreme Court, as well as the number of positions on all other federal courts. The Supreme Court has had 9 members, which it has today, since 1869, and actually, with the exception of just 5 years during the Civil War, since the 1830s. I think traditionally the number of positions on these different courts and how they're distributed, that's supposed to be determined objectively by how many judges a court needs, what its caseload is, that sort of thing. And the Supreme Court actually decides fewer than half the cases every year that it decided 30 years ago. So its needs are no greater than they used to be, and therefore there's no reason to have more than 9 positions.
Theoretically, at least, Tom, the judiciary is viewed as being above politics. If we were to get into a situation where the number of justices was to be expanded and then filled based on ideological considerations, what does that do to really the view of the court and its legitimacy?
Former Chief Justice William Rehnquist said that judicial independence is the crown jewel of our system of government, where you have a judiciary that is as independent from political manipulation as possible. If you read the Declaration of Independence, judicial independence was one of the reasons that we became a nation in the first place. In England, the king was pressuring the courts by saying he would fire judges if they didn't rule his way and this kind of thing. And that was one of the reasons listed in the Declaration for why we became a country. And it's what distinguishes the judiciary in America from most judicial systems around the world. And so, of course, if you then pack the Supreme Court, if you respond to decisions you don't like by manipulating the institution itself, not just by waiting until a vacancy occurs, that's what presidents are supposed to do. Judges leave when they choose to, and when there's a vacancy, the president fills it. But we're talking about manipulating the institution itself, changing the judiciary itself, and then stacking it with judges to get what you want. Well, of course, that destroys the very judicial independence that from the birth of our country has been so very important to the rule of law.
Congress is, of course, very evenly divided. As we speak, we have 50 Republican senators, 48 Democrat or senators who caucus with Democrats. We have two seats still upcoming in these two special elections that will be held next month in Georgia. We have this evenly divided Congress, Tom. We have an evenly divided country, as the last few elections bear out. Were this to be shoved through, what would that do in terms of continuing to polarize the nation?
Well, consider when Franklin Roosevelt wanted to pack the Supreme Court. After the 1936 election, when he was reelected, he had an overwhelming majority of Democrats in both the House and the Senate. There were, I think, 78 Democrats in the United States Senate. And even then, his own Democrats said, look, we can't manipulate the judiciary like this. We can't try to stack the Supreme Court just to get a short-term political benefit. That was when Democrats practically ran the country. And so today, it's still not only a dangerous idea, but given how narrowly divided the country is and how closely divided both houses of Congress are, this would be a devastating political blow. It would further deepen these divisions in our country. And I think it's important to point out, in order to stack the Supreme Court, in order to change the number of justices on the Supreme Court, you'd have to pass legislation. In order to get that legislation past the Senate, which has the filibuster, of course, you'd have to eliminate the filibuster as well, which would fundamentally change the character of the Senate. So you'd have to literally change two branches of government in ways that have never happened before in order to manipulate the courts to get a political outcome. I think all the way around, in half a dozen different ways, that's a terrible step for our country.
Thomas Gipping is Senior Legal Fellow at the Heritage Foundation, where he serves as Deputy Director of the Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies. Tom, tell us a bit about the Heritage Foundation. Also, where can folks go on the web to read more?
The Heritage Foundation has been the leading conservative think tank in the country since 1973. Heritage.org is our website. We have different departments that cover various aspects of public policy. 3 years in a row, we've actually been deemed the most influential think tank in the world on public policy, and we're very proud of that.
Thomas Gipping of the Heritage Foundation. Tom, thank you again for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Scott Parkinson is in Washington, D.C. at the Club for Growth, keeping an eye on what's happening in Congress, also on the unfolding political and legal battles around the country. Scott, good to have you back with us.
It's always great to be with you, Loman. Thank you for having me.
There's been some discussion, perhaps even a little bit of movement, toward yet another COVID-19 relief package. What is the status of that on the Hill?
I'm a little incredulous to this idea that we need to spend another $1 trillion. The bottom line is we had Republican leadership less than a week ago saying that Republicans were going to refocus on debt and deficit issues in 2021 underneath a new administration. Well, first of all, we haven't had that totally resolved. There's nobody that's been inaugurated yet. That happens in January. But Republicans have been forecasting this idea to finally tackle the mandatory spending programs that are driving the debt and deficit issues that we face as a country. And then, you know, they turn around a few days later and there's a bipartisan group of senators that largely led by Chris Coons and Mitt Romney and Lisa Murkowski and a handful of others, and they presented a $900 billion package that ultimately would do nothing to help accommodate a quick recovery in the economy here in America. And instead, it's just really a lot of this stimulus spending. So I think that as Congress moves forward, they need to think about COVID relief, but that means making sure that they have the logistics ready to go for when the vaccination is approved by the FDA and the NIH and everybody else that has a role in that, and making sure that they can deliver a vaccine quickly to people that are at high risk. We did see some guidance this week from the Center for Disease Control that said that they were going to first administer a vaccination to those elderly folks that are in long-term care facilities, and also to folks in hospitals and treatment centers. So there's some good news in terms of the planning that's coming forward. And what I don't understand is why Congress just feels this salacious appetite to move forward with additional stimulus spending when we know that it will do nothing to help with the economic recovery. We've seen what stimulus spending has done in America before. Back in 2008, it led to nearly a decade of stagnation in our country, and it took a new president with President Trump and a new economic agenda after 8 years of Barack Obama to really get the ball moving and to move toward a higher GDP.
You referenced, Scott, that we have not yet sworn in a new president. In fact, President Donald Trump still has not conceded because the legal battle is not yet resolved. Is there anything new on that front?
Well, President Trump gave a little bit of a speech this week to the American people, and he talked about his desire to continue to fight this and make sure that every legal vote was counted and every illegal vote was thrown out. And that's really what I think the Trump legal team's strategy is here, is to identify votes that are clearly problematic, whether there's signatures that don't match on mail-in ballots in Wisconsin, or if you've got high levels of voter turnout above voter registration in various precincts that could call into question the results of a state's electoral decisions. And, you know, I think the president is clearly fighting on behalf of these 74 million people that supported his campaign. When you look at the total number of people that voted in the 2020 election, and you look at who voted in 2016, there are a lot of different ways that it was made more convenient through mail-in balloting to cast a ballot. But was it really that much easier for 25 million new voters to vote in the 2020 election compared to 2016? That's a larger increase in voter turnout than we had combined from Reagan all the way up to Trump's first term. So we need to really make sure that our voter system has the highest integrity. And, you know, I think that the president's legal team has certainly had a couple of hiccups, and they're not winning these lower court decisions right now. But we're still in the middle of the phase of this legal system, and I anticipate that the president will fight this ferociously moving forward to ensure that the results are something that all Americans can accept.
And the president did say this past week, Scott, that if he isn't around for the next 4 years, he'll be back in 4 years. That has a pretty big impact on what the potential 2024 presidential field might look like, does it not?
Well, definitely. And I think the bottom line is President Trump is the leader of the Republican Party. And until he's willing to hand off the keys to the car to somebody else, or to throw the keys up in the air and see who can grab them, you know, he is going to be any sort of a front runner imaginable, and he will freeze out the opposition. I think that you could see a couple of the never Trump Republicans try to take him on, but President Trump would be well positioned to win the GOP nomination in 2024 if he decided to seek re-election. Now, obviously, that's getting way ahead of the skis. We know there's a lot of time still before Inauguration Day in January of 2021, and the legal system needs to be played out. But I do think President Trump is beginning to think about other options and to make sure that nobody else is really going to stick their neck out there where he will have to chop off their political career.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson. Scott Parkinson, of course, with the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
Yeah, the Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C., and we have over 500,000 members from all 50 states in our beautiful country. If your listeners are interested in checking us out, you can become a member for free at clubforgrowth.org. And you can also check us out on Twitter with the Twitter handle at clubforgrowth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, next week we'll check in again. Thank you.
Thank you.
The presumptive Biden administration has made it clear climate change will be a top priority. But it is important that Congress be involved in policy decisions. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine learns more from Josiah Neely of the R Street Institute. Eric?
One of the more interesting things to keep an eye on as the Biden administration takes over next year will be the White House's approach to climate policy. Obviously, that's a big priority for Democrats, but there's really two ways this could go. It could be a serious approach to a potentially serious problem, or it could be all about playing politics. And the key will be the way the Biden administration approaches the problem. Do they involve Congress, or is this going to be all about executive orders and the executive branch? Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Josiah Neely. He is a senior fellow at the R Street Institute, and he joins us now on the phone to talk about this. Josiah, thank you for taking some time and joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So you've got a piece at R Street right now. People can check it out at rstreet.org. Executive action won't save the Biden climate agenda. The basic argument here being that Biden's got to bring Congress in on this, right? And we don't yet know what the final makeup of the Senate will be because we've got those two runoffs in Georgia. And so that's obviously a bit of an unknown here, but Congress needs to be involved in this process one way or the other.
Yeah, that's right. And it is, I think, frustrating if you are a president trying to get your agenda through Congress. And it's particularly frustrating if, as could well be, you have a Senate that's controlled by the opposition party. So there's always, I think, a temptation for presidents to try and do an end run around Congress and pursue through executive action what they would like to do legislatively. But that's generally not a good idea. And I think particularly in this case, the Biden administration is going to find that they just aren't able to do that.
Yeah, they're going to run into trouble, of course, possibly with the courts and all of that, too. And the other thing, obviously, anytime you have executive orders, of course, they're only as good as, the length of your administration in many cases. We're talking about this at kind of a high, right? I mean, we're talking about this in a sort of meta way about like the way in which Biden must approach it rather than talking about the nuts and bolts of policy. But if we can dive down into what the specifics of what a Biden climate policy might look like, how does having to get something through Congress change the ultimate goals or the ambitions?
I think a good way to look at this is to look at the past. The last time we had a Democratic administration was in 2008 with Obama. And of course, he not only had the presidency, but strong majorities in both the House and Senate. And he had an ambitious plan, the Waxman-Markey cap-and-trade bill, which he tried to get through, couldn't get through, and ended up pursuing a scaled-down version of that through EPA called the Clean Power Plan, which was specific to the electricity sector. And you would think that there's a lot of Obama people in the Biden administration incoming, it looks like. And I know before the election, there was a lot of talk of a clean power plan 2.0, right? So something that would be geared towards the electricity system and would try and get emissions down there, move us away from fossil fuel use, et cetera. There's a problem with that. Actually, there's six problems, which is the six justices on the Supreme Court who have in one way or the other expressed skepticism about the ability to use EPA and the Clean Air Act to achieve these ambitious climate goals. So for that reason, I think that is probably off the table for them, and they would have to either come up with something that can get Republican support in the Senate or do something very minor in other agencies, transportation or whatnot. But they're fairly limited in terms of what they can do on their own because the courts are, I think, going to be more vigilant in checking executive power in this case.
We are talking with Josiah Neely. He is a senior fellow at the R Street Institute, talking about what the Biden climate agenda might be, the carbon agenda, the clean energy agenda, whatever you want to call it, for the incoming Biden administration. Josiah, just a minute or so left here, and I want to try to ground some of this in practical policy here. Like, I mean, what is an example of something that, in good faith, the Biden administration could propose to a Republican Senate and that would actually accomplish something in terms of curbing carbon emissions or something like that?
There's a couple of things I'd highlight. One is there's a growing private market for carbon offset, but there's been issues with that market of trying to validate what you're really getting. And I think that there have been proposals for some sort of voluntary verification system that the government could do. That's possible. That's something that possibly you could get Republican support for. Another issue that is NEPA reform, the environmental review process before infrastructure projects, has gotten so out of hand that both the Trump and Obama administrations have tried to make corrections to it. And it's increasingly something that is implicating clean energy infrastructure projects as well as other types of infrastructure. And so that, I think, is another area where you could have fruitful collaboration between the two parties.
Yeah, I like that idea a lot. I like the idea of cutting red tape pretty much all the time, but especially on something like this. Like, hey, right, if we want to make clean energy projects more competitive with traditional energy projects or dirty energy, you know, then make it easier to build those things. Like, that obviously seems like a pretty clear market-based mechanism there. We're unfortunately out of time for today. Josiah Neely from the R Street Institute, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And again, that is Josiah Neely. He is the Director of Texas Policy and the Resident Senior Fellow for Energy at the R Street Institute. Check out his work at rstreet.org, including his latest piece, Executive Action Won't Save the Biden Climate Agenda. You can check out our coverage of these issues of the incoming Biden administration, everything else that's going on at Reason.com. And for Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm.
A Biden administration would take America back to a calmer presidency, but one which would be destructive to the ideals of liberty and equal opportunity. So says Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, on this American Radio Journal commentary.
The 2020 elections saw record turnouts of voters across the land, and that's a great thing for our republic. The turmoil of the last 4 years, caused by incessant conflict and attempts to oust a duly elected president, caused many Americans to become weary of the turmoil. Some yearned for the good old days of the prior administration or just for tranquility, even if it meant sacrificing one's liberties. Even ads from Joe Biden's campaign stressed unity. An American president representing all Americans, they had an almost Jimmy Stewart-like appeal to peace. The progressives claimed the riots were President Trump's fault, and that only with the change of administration would we return to the good old days in which progressives represented all Americans. Cries and pleas for unity were really pleas or demands for conformity to the progressive perspective, or the riots would continue, they implied. The stark absurdity of these claims, which went unchecked by the media, represent one of the biggest scams in American political history. The good old days of the progressives did not feel so good to those who felt completely unrepresented by Obama, Biden, Pelosi, and the entire Democratic Party. That is part of the reason we had a stunning defeat of Hillary Clinton at the hands of Donald Trump in 2016. The feel-good policies of many liberals were so fraught with unintended consequences that the very help that people believe they are providing to those less fortunate are in fact ensuring that those same disadvantaged people are denied the very opportunities afforded to all other Americans. The liberal programs that create the most dependency for people in need provide subsidies rather than help develop capabilities. Trump reversed that, but the wariness of the assaults by progressives against the president had the reverse effect on people willing to return to the past failed policies, even though so many were hurt beyond comprehension by those very policies. How soon we all forgot the pain and suffering of just 4 years ago. Some of the very policies that had unintended consequences and cruel results include the progressives' favorite shove-it-down-your-throat programs designed to assert government control over one's life at the expense of your freedom and liberty. Even the claims of unity are clamors for conformity. All one needed to do was conform and Tifa would stop rioting. Diversity of opinion was called hate speech and censored by Facebook, Twitter, and fact-checkers. The thought police of the book 1984 became fully empowered by the progressive left during the Trump presidency in reaction to the stunning electoral results on 2016 to make sure that that success could not repeat itself in 2020, or so they thought. During the Obama years and prior, there was a primary and secondary school system that did not foster excellence with its students and was doomed to produce students not qualified and being able to become independent in the future. The very foundation of any great culture is a quality education system, which recognizes individual learning differences while at the same time fostering exceptional education results based upon the abilities of the student. The unfunded liabilities of so many cities, communities, and states also had profound implications on our entire nation. When these pensions were originally granted, such pension plans were relatively common in large corporate America. The difference, though, is that the unfunded obligations in corporate America were often met by corporate bankruptcies. In the case of government, such unfunded obligations are met with massive tax increases, leading citizens, most now without pensions, almost no hope of ever retiring. The city of Detroit is but one example of a looming national pension disaster. While a corporation cannot force their customers to pay for its poorly thought-out decisions, government, however, has the ability to pass laws to legislate irresponsible behavior and thereby harming its own citizens in the process. Another example is that porous or open borders only foster an influx of people who have limited ability to exercise the benefits of the American dream. Such policies relegate illegal immigrants to low-paying and, in many cases, dead-end jobs with limited future for them or their families. Another progressive ideal, I guess. One final example of the cruelty of liberalism in bygone years, food stamp programs were exploding in cost and availability, which masked the problem that economic opportunity was languishing. Massive government regulations and cost had made it difficult for employers to provide higher pay during the Obama years. Higher costs for apartments, food, clothing, and medical insurance make more and more Americans dependent upon the food stamp program. If this country and if liberals had been serious about helping Americans and those less fortunate, policies needed to be enacted which encourage people to develop their own capabilities and become self-sufficient. This is one of the reasons Trump prevailed in 2016. The Obama years may have seemed tranquil to progressive, but they were destructive to the ideals of liberty, personal responsibility, self-determination, and equal opportunities to live the life your parents could only dream of. If only we had a press that was not so biased as to challenge the assumptions and the commentary of all candidates for president, and not just those with whom they disagree. The unity proclaimed by the left if Biden becomes president may become the bonds of servitude to a government which tolerates not diversity of opinion, but only conformity to the state. Those who are willing to sacrifice safety and calm for their freedoms will get neither. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KCNW-AM in Kansas City, Missouri, WWNL-AM in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, along with WBRI-AM in Indianapolis, Indiana. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.